Chapter. That's where most of our study will be tonight. And to the brother who stole one of my outlines and preached it, I would just say that's all right, brother. The preacher I stole it from didn't mind either, so it's all fine. Well, I always appreciate being able to teach the gospel no matter where I am, whether I'm at home or whether I'm at our home away from home, what used to be our home here in Kokomo, Indiana. We always enjoy coming back, and Brother David and I have come up here for the last 3, 4, 5 years, I guess, and somehow he gets invited to lead singing and I get invited to preach, and I appreciate the opportunity. Always happy to teach the Word of God. Tonight we're going to look at a dramatic story that is in the midst of a group of dramatic stories about Jesus. In Matthew chapters 8 and 9, we're presented with a series of extraordinary events about Jesus, miraculous events, every one of them. And they happen in this order. Matthew chapter 8 opens with the healing of a leper, and then there's the healing of the centurion's servant, and then of Peter's mother-in-law. And then you have that great story in Matthew chapter 8, beginning at verse 23, about Jesus calming the storm. Remember when the disciples were on the Sea of Galilee and this great storm came up, and they said, "Master, don't you care that we're perishing?" Well, they didn't perish, and Jesus saved them from the storm. And we'll hearken back to that in just a moment. But following that, you have a story about the casting out of demons in the country of the Gadarenes. And then as you go into chapter 9, you see Jesus forgiving sin, healing a paralyzed man. There's a girl restored to life, and a woman, an elderly woman who is healed. There's the healing of two blind men, and then at the end of Matthew chapter 9, you have the healing of a man who could not speak, a man who was mute. 10 miracles of various sorts in the space of just 2 chapters. And why would these be grouped together? It's like Matthew says, let me just put a bunch of Jesus miracles together and let me show you what he can do, show you what he did. And so these stories show us something about the power of Jesus, and that power is there to convince us that he is who he claimed to be, that he is God's son. But I would ask you a question. Most of you, in fact, probably all of you, have read those 2 chapters at one time or another. Is there one of those miracles that stands out to you as being the most dramatic? Any of them that stand out to you? What do you think? It's all right to help the preacher. You have one that stands out? Kevin? Yeah, calming the storm. In fact, when I was here last year, I presented a lesson from the text of, actually from Mark. Mark and Matthew and Luke all talk about the calming of the storm. But what a dramatic story that is. And I entitled my lesson, A Journey with Jesus on a Dark and Stormy Night. It wasn't that it was just a storm, but it was past evening. It was late at night when this took place. That's indeed a dramatic story. And remember when the disciples cried out to Jesus and, "Master, don't you care that we're perishing?" And of course Jesus said, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And then he spoke to the wind and he spoke to the sea, and then there was tranquility. And the disciples, what did they say? "Who can this man be? Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey his will?" That's a remarkable story. And I certainly count that as one of the most dramatic. I look, though, at the next one about the demon possession, where Jesus cast out the legion of demons, and they go into a herd of swine. And I will tell you, that's another highly dramatic story. It's recounted in Matthew chapter 8, verses 28 to 34. It's also found in Mark 5 and in Luke chapter 8. Let's read from Matthew's account. I'm reading from Matthew chapter 8, verses 28 to 34. And in this text, I'll be reading from the ESV translation. When they came to the other side, that is, to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, The storm is over. They're on the other side now in the country of the Gadarenes. That puts them on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. There were two demon-possessed men who met Jesus coming out of the tombs and so fierce that no one could pass that way. Everybody was afraid of these men. And behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now, a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, that is, they begged Jesus, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." And so they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled. And going into the city, they told everything, especially what happened to the demon-possessed man, or men in this case. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. They did not want Jesus around any longer. Now, Mark and Luke both give a larger account of this story, and they give supplemental details to the story. Mark and Luke both put the emphasis on one man. Matthew tells us about two. And I think the reason that Mark and Luke put the emphasis on one man is that one man wanted to follow Jesus and become one of his personal disciples. It's in Mark chapter 5 and verse 9, though, when the name is given Legion, we're called Legion because we are many. Well, is there anything that we can learn from this dramatic incident? I think there are several things that we might be able to learn from this. First of all, we learn something about the existence of demons. And we need to understand that demons were real. Jesus always treated, whether it was demons or whether it was Satan, he always treated them as real. Demon possession served as a physical, visible evidence of an unseen spiritual world. That there is a spiritual world that exists that is unseen to the human eye. But in this case, when the demons were manifested by taking control of someone's speech or taking control of someone's body or however it might have been manifested, then you could see in a visible way the activities of this unseen, invisible world. Now you contrast what Jesus does here in this case, because he interacts with them. You contrast that with some of the modern thinkers who say, well, demon possession was a way that ancient people, in their ignorance, described mental illness. This was really about two men who were mentally ill. And maybe that sounds okay until you consider that the demons go into the pigs, and now do we have a herd of mentally ill pigs? I mean, think about the consequence of that. And that doctrine that says that this was just a way of describing mental illness because they didn't know of any other way, that not only impugns the integrity of Jesus, the Jesus who claimed to be the way, the truth, and the life, it impugns his integrity, but also brands the Bible as a book of ignorance. No, that just will not do. Jesus always treated these demons and Satan himself as being real. Now, some say that demon and Satan are just a figurative way to describe evil. But Jesus doesn't do that. He treats them as real as he interacts with them. And so, indeed, the demons were real. But here's a second point that is critically important for us to know, that these demons knew that their time on earth was limited. Look at Matthew chapter 8 and verse 29, and no matter which translation you have, it's going to be worded about the same. When Jesus encounters these men, it says in verse 29, "Behold, they cried out, 'What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?'" That last sentence posed as a question to Jesus. Have you come here to torment us before the time? This is a key passage in understanding demon possession. These demons knew that they were not going to be allowed to roam the earth forever. Their time was limited, and they knew that when that time came, they were going to be tormented. That's why they asked Jesus, "Have you come to torment us before the time?" They knew that Jesus had the power to shorten their time and to send them to the place of torment. In Luke, the 8th chapter, in verse number 31, Jesus speaks of their destiny as being the abyss. Let me read that text for you. Luke chapter 8 and verse number 31. If I can find the verse, I think it is here. Come back. Yes, this is the same case, except it's from Luke's gospel. It says they begged Jesus not to command them to depart into the abyss. The word abyss there just means pit, and it's used a number of times in the New Testament, but it's never a place where you want to go. These demons knew that their time on earth was limited and that they would be their time could be cut short by Jesus. This text, Matthew chapter 8 and verse number 29, as well as other texts, causes us to conclude that demon possession does not occur today. There are some people who wrongly assume that demon possession has always existed from the beginning of the world and even to this very hour. Demon possession is widespread. But I challenge you to go back to the Old Testament and read from Genesis all the way to Malachi. I do not think you can find a single case that could clearly be called demon possession. The one case that most people offer is the case of Saul, King Saul, after the Lord had left him. It says that an evil spirit from the Lord overtook him. An evil spirit from the Lord had to do with his disposition. It wasn't demon possession. It was Saul becoming depressed because God had rejected him as king. And what did he do when he was so depressed? He would call upon David to come and play on his harp and his heart would feel better. No, that's not a case of demon possession. And if demon possession was all over the Old Testament, you would find numerous examples of it. But you don't. I've been recently in a lengthy discussion with a man, back and forth. He's scrambling, trying to find a case of demon possession in the Old Testament. And he's just not finding any. Why wouldn't he just give it up? Well, because he wants to believe that demon possession has always been around. It's always been widespread, just like it is in the New Testament. When you open your Bible in the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, you'll find case after case of demon possession. Why this explosion of demon possession in the four Gospels, and yet you struggle to find any case of it at all in the Old Testament? And in the case of this particular man that I've been studying with, he wants to believe it's here today because it will excuse a lot of sin. You see, a man might have a lusting demon. That's why he watches pornography. He can't help that. A man might have an alcohol demon. He might have a gambling demon because this demon forces him to gamble. It forces him to drink alcohol. He may have a lying demon that forces him to tell lies. A cursing demon that causes him to use foul language all the time. You see, a lot of people like that idea of sin being attributed to demons that are possessing a person. And that kind of gets them away from being personally responsible for their activities and their actions. That's what he really is all about. And I think a lot of people are just like that. No, I don't think there's any demon possession today. That doesn't mean Satan is not alive and doing his work. But the idea of demon possession and causing all manner of sin, that is just not biblical. You don't find it in the Old Testament. But what you do find, when you open the four Gospels, you find case after case of demon possession. I believe that God allowed, this is my understanding, that God allowed demon possession during the ministry of Jesus in order that Jesus might demonstrate his power over the forces of Satan. The possession then coincided with that age of miracles that was the miracles that Jesus performed and the miracles that his apostles and others performed, demonstrating God's power in a visible, physical way over the forces of Satan. But demon possession, I think, falls basically into that first century period. You don't find it really much before that, if at all. And you don't find it much after that, if at all. Power to cast the demons out was a spiritual gift. And that power ended with the other spiritual gifts. And the power to cast out demons no longer needed. And again, why did God allow it? It was to show the power of Christ in a visible physical way over Satan. Now, I've had people ask the question, where do demons come from? The Bible doesn't tell us. And it is theorized that they are fallen angels. And I think that's as good an explanation as any. But again, the Bible doesn't really say. And when Jesus cast those demons out, that was a way of binding Satan. Over in the book of Luke, in Luke chapter 11, here in a case where Jesus had cast out demons, these men had said that Jesus is casting out demons, but he's doing it by the power of Beelzebub. And here's what Jesus says in response to that. This is Luke chapter 11, beginning at verse 20. Jesus says, "But if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you." Now listen to this in Luke 11:21. He says, "When a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are safe." The strong man here is talking about Satan. "But when one stronger than he attacks the strong man and overcomes him and takes away his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoil." Now, what Jesus is saying is, I am the stronger man. I have demonstrated my power over Satan and over all of his forces. And so I think that's why God allowed the demon possession to occur during that period of time, so that Jesus could bind Satan, prohibit his activities. Now, someone says, well, Max, if demon possession no longer occurs today, then what about these claims of exorcism, where people are casting out demons? Well, I think people, one, imagine the possession, then they imagine an exorcism. It cannot be demonstrated that anyone today is possessed by a demon. Demons were imbued with supernatural strength, supernatural knowledge. In fact, our text that we've looked at in Luke chapter 8, and I'm looking at Luke chapter 8 and verse number 28, when these demons saw Jesus, it says that this man in whom the demon was, when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." Notice here, this demon has supernatural knowledge of who Jesus is. Secondly, this demon had the ability to break the chains that had been binding him. Supernatural knowledge, supernatural strength. People today who claim demon possession, they have neither one of those things. And so I think there is no demon possession today. I don't think we can establish that it exists, but be cautious. This does not mean that Satan is not active. Satan is working in different ways today. And he is at work in order to try to deceive us and turn us away from God. That's why in the book of Ephesians in chapter 6 and verse number 10, it said, "Finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God." Why do we need to put on the whole armor of God? He says that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. Because we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand firm. And so here, the Bible is very clear that we're still engaged in spiritual warfare, even though Satan can no longer possess people and send demons to take over one's body or life. But I want us to see something more than just talking about the demons themselves. There's a greater story and lesson for us in this story. I think that sometimes when we read a story like this, we get so consumed trying to figure out about the demons, and we worry about the fate of those poor pigs that drowned, that we miss the greater story. The greater story here is about the one who cast out the demons. So if I were to ask you, what do you think are the main lessons that we can get from this account? Here are some things that you might say. You might say, well, it's about the fact maybe that demons are real. Well, that's a good lesson. That's a lesson for us. But that's not the main lesson. There's obviously more to it than that. Someone says, well, maybe it's about the failure of men to follow Jesus, because these men, when they learned what Jesus had done, what did they do? Look at the end of the text that we read. Look at verse number 34, Matthew chapter 8, verse 34. Here comes the people out of the city. Behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. Here's someone with miraculous powers. Here's someone who can fix these two men who are demon-possessed. These men that chains cannot hold. These men that are preventing anyone from even walking that way. Jesus has fixed both of these men. And now these people say, please, we're begging you, leave our place. These miracles should have caused the townspeople here to follow Jesus, but that's not what they did. Instead of thanking him, they begged him to leave. The thought that he might be all that he claims to be is frightening to some folks, and I think it was frightening to these folks. They would rather have him gone than have his blessings. Those townspeople should have just stayed and listened to Jesus, Master, teach us. But that's not what they did. They said, please leave. Well, what about the problem of the pigs? You know, people say, ain't it awful what Jesus did here? These poor herdsmen, they lost all their pigs. You know, I don't pretend to have all the answers to the problem of the pigs. But I'll tell you this, if this is a Jewish swine herder, he would have been violating the law of God. Those were unclean animals. You had no reason to be a herder of pigs because their flesh was unclean. But you know what? There's a deeper issue here. Whether this man or these men who herded the pigs, whether they were Jews or Gentiles, God has the right to do as he wills with his creation. And I think we miss the point oftentimes on that. I'm looking at Psalm 50. Listen to this. This is Psalm 50, beginning at verse 10 and down to, well, a couple of verses. God says, every beast of the forest is mine. What does that mean? That means all the animals belong to God. If they belong to him, then he can do what he wants with them. All the cattle on the thousand hills. Who are they? They're mine, says God. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine. Even if it's the pigs who move in the field, they're mine. And so God can do as he wills with the things that he has created. And someone says, well, God didn't put very much value on this man's herd. And you're exactly right. You know, we put so much value on the things that we say we possess, whether it's our animals in the field, whether it's our cars, whether it's our houses. We put so much value on the things that we possess, and I don't think God puts as much value on those things as we do. In fact, they're all his anyway, and he can do as he chooses. God just doesn't look at the things that we have the way we look at them. These are God's animals. God can do whatever he wants. But I'll tell you what you can learn here. These demons say, cast us into the herd of swine. And then what do? They run down the hill and into the Sea of Galilee, and they're all drowned. Satan is at work here. Satan is a destroyer. He destroyed that herd of pigs, just like he wants to destroy men. That's what Satan does. He is a destroyer. And you know what's missing here in this story? And I have to scratch my head just thinking, what is really happening here? There's something missing really bad. Why is there no rejoicing over these two men who've been freed from demons? Why is there no happiness in the city? The people in the city, they can't walk down this way because these demons are there and will prevent them. These demons hurt themselves, they'll hurt other people. But there doesn't seem to be any happiness or joy over that. No, we're concerned about the pigs. You know, get out of our territory. You hurt our stuff. And I'll tell you what, whether in Jesus' day or in our day, sometimes there's more concern over the pigs in this story than over the people in this story. I'll tell you, folks, we should value people over pigs. If you were there on that day that happened, could you have rejoiced that these men were freed from the demon possession? Or would you say, oh, the poor herdsmen, the poor pigs? Listen, I'm not an animal hater. But those are God's animals, and He can do with them as He wants. But we're God's children. We've all been made by God. We're created in the image of God. Pigs are not. We should value people over pigs. We should value people over any of our possessions, no matter how prized our possessions might be. Jesus put His priorities where they ought to be. Jesus brought peace to these two men's lives. And He actually brought peace to the community where these men had caused so much trouble. And they can't seem to rejoice over it. That's sad. And by the way, let me make one other observation about the pigs. You know, over the years, I've talked to a lot of atheists, skeptics, agnostics, and they will speak against Jesus because of His destruction of the pigs. Jesus did something wrong. He hurt that man's property, destroyed it. I will tell you, my friend, when the atheist, agnostic, or skeptic, whatever he wants to call himself, humanist, when he starts criticizing Jesus about the pigs, he just made a big mistake. Someone says, why? Well, no charge can be made against Jesus unless this incident actually happened. Have you ever thought of that? Don't criticize Jesus if you don't think it happened. Those who speak against Jesus for destroying the pigs have to admit that it really happened. Otherwise, the charge against Jesus is pointless. Can you see that? Are the skeptics willing to admit that Jesus actually cast out demons? And so if a skeptic says to me, oh, Jesus did wrong here in destroying that man's property. Oh, so are you going to say that Jesus did what the text says? That He cast out the demons? Well, yeah. Well, wait a minute. You're just admitting, one, that Jesus exists, which sometimes you try to say He doesn't. You're admitting that He had supernatural power. You're admitting that the Bible is true. I thought you were a skeptic. But he says, no, I don't believe. I don't believe Jesus did this. Then why are you criticizing Jesus over something you say He didn't do? Whether you answer yes or no, you have no grounds for criticizing Jesus. Well, that's so much for the problem of the pigs. Okay. Someone says, well, I think the lesson might be about Satan and his activities and what he does to men's lives. You know, think about these two men. We don't know their history. We only know that Jesus encounters them. We know the condition that he finds them in, and we know the condition that he leaves them in. But Satan robbed these men of their sanity, robbed them of their self-control, filled them with fears. He robbed them of whatever family relationship they had. These two men, they're someone's sons. They could be someone's husbands. They could be someone's fathers. But having to be chained up because these men are out of control and they're hurting people, they were robbed of all human relationships that they might have had. That's what Satan does. And even without demon possession, Satan does that. He's a destroyer today. Jesus undid Satan's deeds and restored these two men to a normal life. One other lesson that might be drawn here. Maybe it's about how helpless humanity is. You know, the people of this town, what could they do to help these two guys? The most they could do is put chains on them. but the chains wouldn't hold them because with the demon possession, they had supernatural strength. And so this community couldn't fix these men. Unable to cure or change the circumstance these men were in. And I'll tell you, folks, it's that way today, too. Humanity is still helpless. Oh, I know, we say, oh, you know, we've learned so much about the human mind and we're doing so much better. Things are getting so much better. We're evolving into a higher and higher state and we're learning more and more about how we ought to. If we're learning so much more about how we ought to live and how we ought to act, why do we have so much crime in our streets? Why do we have so many suicides? Why so many drug overdoses? I will tell you, culture will never cure the problem that we have. Our problem is sin, and Jesus is the answer. Jesus was the answer here, and He's the answer today. Jesus rescues, He redeems, and He restores. That's what He did to these two men. Well, I don't think any of those are the real lesson. They're all important. But here's the real lesson, ladies and gentlemen. This story and the lessons are about Jesus. You see, these other things, these are all good lessons, but they focus on the wrong character. The lesson isn't about the townspeople who rejected Jesus. It's not about the pigs or the demons or even the two men who were healed by Jesus. The story and the lessons are about Jesus. Jesus is the central character. He's the center. This account is about the identity of Jesus. That's the central issue. I began by talking about Matthew 8 and 9. Remember two chapters put together? 10 miracles, one after another after another. This whole section is about the identity of Jesus. You remember those men in the boat when Jesus was calming the storm and Jesus said, "Peace, be still," and the wind and the waves ceased and the men looked at the circumstance. They marveled and they said, "What sort of man is this? Who is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" That was their question. But the demons answer, don't they? Yeah, the men said, "Who can this be?" But the demons answer, "Son of God." They answered for those men. They don't ask who, they know who. The demons not only recognize him as the Son of God, but they also recognize his great authority. They recognize that they must obey his word. And when Jesus is going to cast them out of those two men, what do they do? They're going to say, "No, we're not going." No, Jesus says one word. He says, "Go." And the demons went out at that moment. That's the main lesson for us today. Jesus is the Son of God. And this story and the other 9 accounts that are given in chapters 8 and 9 of Matthew have that same lesson. The demons believe that Jesus is the Son of God. But you know what? There's a problem with them believing. Oh, it's okay that they believe, but like James chapter 2 and verse 19 says, the demons believe and they shudder. Another translation says, they believe and they tremble. And here in our text, what did they say? They believe. But they said, "Have you come here to torment us before the time?" They shudder because their belief is only one of recognition. They recognize who Jesus is, but you know that the demons are not followers of Jesus. They don't accept him. They recognize him, but they don't accept him. And there's like so many people today. How many people in Kokomo, Indiana, or Beaumont, Texas, where we live? How many people say, "Oh, yes, I recognize who Jesus is. Son of God, powerful, fine. But don't bother me." They don't accept him as Lord of their lives. And yet people will say, "Yeah, I believe Jesus is the Son of God." That's no small thing. That's not merely a matter of intellectual assent. It's a matter of allegiance. I baptized a man about 55 years old Thursday evening. I baptized a man. And before I baptized him, he opened his mouth and said, "I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God." That's a power statement. It's weighty. and it means something. And it is like, it's like a pledge of allegiance. Since Jesus is the Son of God, that's my belief. That's what I will hold to, and I will be allegiant to Him for the rest of my days. And yet our culture today, oh yeah, Jesus, Son of God, fine. Let's go on now about our own business. If I acknowledge Jesus as God's Son in my mind, that information needs to get to my heart. It needs to get to my hands. It needs to get to my feet and to my mouth. Because I need to put myself to work. I need to put my hands and my feet at work in doing His service. I need to speak His word and His will. If I really have that belief that He is the Son of God, I need to serve Him, speak of Him, walk in His ways. And I need to count the cost of following Him. In Matthew, the 8th chapter, in verses 18 to 22, I was reading this text just a little while ago. Jesus sees a crowd around Him, and He gave orders to go over to the other side, and a scribe came up to Him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And it's like Jesus says, "Oh, really? You're really going to follow me?" He says, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have their nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay His head." Another of the disciples came to Him and said, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And this man comes to Jesus and says, "I want to follow you." Yeah, everybody wants to follow Jesus, except when my own will gets in the way of Jesus. Or when I say, Jesus' will gets in my way. Jesus says, I want to first go do something else. I have other priorities. And Jesus said, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. I need to count the cost of following Him. Jesus is the Son of God. That's what Matthew 8 and Matthew 9 are about. And so when I was here last year, you allowed me to preach on Jesus calming the sea. So tonight I've talked about the demons. We've still got 8 more miracles in this section that we could address maybe on other occasions. But I think I understand why Jesus works all these miracles, and Matthew groups all of them together in this short section. I think he wants to present evidence. Matthew wants to present evidence to us about who Jesus is, His identity. You know, the disciples saw these miracles. They saw what Jesus did here in casting out the demon. And then eventually, what did they say? "Now we are sure that you are the Son of God." And what that meant to those men, with the exception of one, with the exception of Judas, it meant total allegiance and commitment to Jesus Christ until their lives on this earth ended. And believe it or not, that's what Jesus wants from you too. He wants you to have total allegiance and commitment to Him till the end of life. And I would just say to us, if we were to ever think of leaving Jesus, as some folks do, you realize COVID has been rough on religion in America. 20 to 30% of people in America, across all churches, 20 to 30% have quit during COVID. They no longer attend, they're no longer a part of, they no longer send in their contribution. They've gone their own way. So a lot of folks have thought about leaving Jesus. And if that ever happens to us, if we ever think about leaving Jesus, what are we going to do with the evidence of Matthew 8 and Matthew 9? These things are true. These things were witnessed by those who were there. They're recorded. And you have the 4 Gospels, which contain so much eyewitness testimony as to what Jesus did. People were there, real people like you and me. They saw. And now we have the record. So if we're ever thinking about leaving Jesus, we have, Brother David and I know of one family that's really been close to us in the past, was part of our congregation. They were committed, working hard, devoted disciples. But they came to a point in their life where for whatever reason, they decided they didn't want to be servants of Jesus any longer. I want to talk to them. Let me sit down and study with you. Let's look at the evidence. Because you've got to get past the evidence in order to really become an unbeliever. No, we don't want to do that. No. We don't want to look at the evidence. You see, people do not leave Jesus because there's a lack of evidence as to who he is. People leave Jesus in spite of the evidence, because the evidence is overwhelming. I remind us of this text in John 20, verses 30 and 31, where you've got eyewitness testimony throughout that chapter. John writes at the end of the chapter, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written, he says. These seven that I've recorded for you, these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. And so, the evidence is there. In our text, the demons say Jesus is God's Son. The disciples see that. I want us to see it. He is the Son of God. He speaks as only the Son of God could speak, acts as only the Son of God could act, did what only the Son of God could do. He rules creation, he judges evil, and he saves his people. Has he saved you yet? Are you right with God tonight? I hope you are. But if not, he wants to save you. But you get to decide whether or not you're going to do that, whether or not you're going to submit to his will. Because he doesn't, the demons, they had no choice. When he said go, they had to go. But you get a choice as to whether or not you're going to serve Jesus. This coming Sunday, I'm going to talk a little bit about choices and consequences. Every choice we make has consequences. The best choice you can ever make is the choice to follow God, to follow his Son Jesus. The worst choice you can ever make is to reject it. Because it's a matter of life and death for you, heaven and hell for you. If you need to respond to the gospel call tonight, we invite you to come now as we stand and sing, come now, please.